From Maine Public Radio and mainepublic.org, I'm Nora Flaherty with the news on this day in Maine, Tuesday, March 10th, 2020.
This Day in Maine is made possible by the Dempsey Center, making life better for people managing the impact of cancer. Locations in Lewiston and South Portland. DempseyCenter.org.
State public health officials say there are still no confirmed cases of COVID-19 in Maine, but are advising Mainers to prepare. Mel Leary has more.
Dr. Nirav Shah, director of the State Center for Disease Control, says Maine hospitals and healthcare providers are preparing for the likely arrival of the new coronavirus. And like other states, Maine will have to manage its supply of medical gowns, gloves, masks, and other protective equipment.
The availability of supplies, as it's called, PPE, or personal protective equipment, has been a challenge not just in Maine, but across the country.
Shaw says the CDC has a team set up just to keep track of PPE and will be able to coordinate the sending of supplies to wherever they're needed. He says individuals can best protect themselves and their families by eating a healthy diet, exercising, getting a good night's sleep, and getting a flu shot. It won't protect them from the coronavirus, but will reduce their risk of getting sick from the flu. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Mal Leary.
A natural gas company that serves more than 4,800 customers in southern Maine has been fined $50,000 by state utility regulators and agreed to a number of specific steps to ensure compliance. The Maine Public Utilities Commission approved a consent agreement today with Maine Natural Gas of Brunswick. PUC Chairman Phil Bartlett says the violations were related to quality control, assurances systems, and testing.
There were simply inadequate quality controls in place. A number of gaps were identified by our gas safety staff.
Maine Natural Gas is a wholly owned subsidiary of Avangrid, the parent company of Central Maine Power. Bartlett calls the $50,000 penalty significant and commensurate with potential safety violations, which occurred over a number of years. He says the commission wanted to send the appropriate message that the problems had to be fixed. And the Maine Ethics Commission has voted to open an investigation into whether a dark money group that opposes Central Maine Power's proposed 145-mile hydropower transmission project should have registered as a political action committee or a ballot question committee. Stop the Corridor would have to disclose donors if it is required to register as a PAC. In weather tonight, showers and flurries ending, with skies clearing in most of the state and lows in the low 20s to the low 30s. Tomorrow, partly sunny and breezy. The University of Maine system's planning to keep its dorms and dining halls open to students during its spring break next week as an effort to curb the spread of COVID-19. The system's encouraging students to stay on campus over spring break for free to minimize the likelihood that they will be exposed to the coronavirus. Daniel Malloy is the chancellor of the UMaine system. Chancellor Malloy, I've heard a lot about colleges and universities canceling classes, but I haven't heard a lot about schools keeping facilities open, although I know that's what the CDC is recommending. How unusual is this, and how will it help stop the spread of coronavirus?
Well, you know, Maine is a special place, and what we're saying to our students who would otherwise be leaving to go to states where the outbreak is substantially larger, or there are many identified cases, or because people will be surging to a particular area of the country, that the spread will naturally happen at higher rates. What we're saying to students is don't do it. Right now, we actually don't have a recognized case in Maine as I speak to you. I'm sure we're going to have some number of cases, but this might be a very safe place for you to stay. It's not as warm as Miami, but there are going to be a lot fewer people carrying the virus here than there will be in Miami, at least for the foreseeable future. Why not keep yourself as safe as possible? And in essence, at a number of our campuses, by closing dormitories, we're forcing people to go to areas where the virus is far more and widely spread. So I thought it was the right thing to do. And of course, we're going to assess risks on a daily basis, a weekly basis. We're going to promulgate additional rules or regulations as things develop and as we see best practices in the nation. But I think we have engaged in developing best practices here in Maine.
How is the system going to handle the additional cost of keeping the dorms open during spring break?
This is one of those things where you're darned if you do and you're darned if you don't. We would save a lot of money by sending people home and closing our institutions and not having to pay, to feed people. But that would be wrong to do. The idea that we would play a role in making people putting people at greater risk just doesn't sound like the main thing to do. So we're going to figure it out, to tell you the truth.
I have been just looking online. Various schools have decided that they will just close their campuses and ask students to leave and not come back this year. Why has the UMaine system made a different decision?
As I'm talking to you today, we don't have a confirmed case of the virus in Maine. Now, there's no doubt in my mind that we're going to have one eventually. But again, right now, our campuses are pretty darn safe. What I suppose, in essence, we're saying is we're in a better position to assure people if we discourage people from going to places that have more exposure. We don't want those people coming back to the state of Maine and exposing people. The vast majority of our students are, in fact, Maine residents, but Maine residents like to go to Florida or the Caribbean during holidays, too. And then we have a number of students who don't have a place to go home. They've made their arrangements to be here through May 9th. Their parents may have moved. They, for some reason, may not have a place to go back to. If we tell everybody they have to leave, what's the guarantee they have any place to go to? Now, that's maybe a relatively small number of people, but they're part of our family, and we should do the best we can to meet their needs.
Older people are more impacted by COVID-19. What special accommodations do you anticipate making for, say, older faculty members to teach classes?
I think older faculty members will make their decision on how they want to proceed. We're making it easier for older faculty or faculty with a compromised health to go to online learning as soon as tomorrow. With the approval of they have to notify the students and they have to notify their president and their provost. But I am saying quite clearly to that group of our instructors that we want to protect you and we will do everything in our power to protect you.
All right. Daniel Malloy is the chancellor of the University of Maine system. Chancellor Malloy, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
As we've been hearing, older adults do seem to be at higher risk of getting very sick from COVID-19. And Maine's population is one of the oldest in the U.S., with more than 20% of residents over the age of 65. That has nursing homes, home care organizations, and senior groups on high alert, as the illness has now infected hundreds of people across the country and caused more than 24 deaths. Patty White has more.
With the possibility of a coronavirus outbreak looming, organizations that provide home care are dusting off emergency plans and ramping up efforts to prevent and, if necessary, contain the virus. Kathy Bean is the lead nurse for telehealth and community health at Northern Light Home Care and Hospice.
It's prepare for the worst, hope for the best.
That means making sure clients have enough medication and food on hand in case there's a disruption in supply or a quarantine, says Bean. Northern Light Home Care is taking preparedness seriously, she says, but in many ways, protocols are already ingrained in the workplace.
You know, if we get a bad snowstorm in Maine, we are using these plans. And if we get a windstorm or a rainstorm, we use these plans. So these are all things that we know how to do.
Efforts also include more staff training and reminders on infection control, says Robert Abel. He's the chief nursing officer for Maine Health Care at Home.
Hand washing, how to use protective personal equipment, and be able to tell us what they would do in certain situations.
The goal is to keep the 1,600 home care clients they serve across Southern Maine, as well as the staff that serves them, healthy. If staff do become ill, Abel says, that's a potential issue because the state already has a shortage of health care workers.
One of the benefits that we have at this agency, and I know some others in the state, is we use telehealth. So we're able to provide virtual care to some of our patients. So we think that would be helpful in a reduced staffing situation.
Nursing homes are also planning for the possibility of staff shortages, says Rick Erb, the president and CEO of the Maine Healthcare Association, which represents 200 nursing and assisted living facilities.
We'll do the best that we can. We are working with DHHS licensing on what the staffing requirements are and how those will be enforced. And, of course, the bottom line is that we have to be able to provide the type of care required based on the needs of the residents. So no matter what, that will be addressed.
Erb says nursing homes are also doing more sanitizing and screening. Visitors are asked about their health, travel history, and possible exposure to others who've been to areas where outbreaks have occurred. He says the Maine Healthcare Association has created a website specifically for its members to provide current information and recommendations.
The population we care for, which is typically age 80 and up, with already existing health issues, makes them most vulnerable. So we are in a unique position to begin with. People live in close quarters with each other. The potential for an outbreak to spread is certainly great when you have that many people living in one building together. So this is an issue for us.
Organizations that serve older adults in the community are also taking precautions. Betsy Sawyer-Manter is president and CEO of Seniors Plus in Lewiston. The nonprofit provides home visiting, Meals on Wheels, and other services in three western Maine counties. Sawyer-Manter says staff now call clients before visiting to make sure they're healthy.
Sometimes we will deliver a meal, but we'll ask them not to open the door until after we leave, and we'll just leave their door unlocked, and we just sit their meal inside the door, and so that we're just trying to not have exposure either from us or to them.
Sawyer-Manter says Seniors Plus is fielding a lot of questions from its clients about what to do. She says she advises them to have an adequate supply of medications on hand and to get the flu shot. It won't protect against the novel coronavirus, she says, but it's one less illness to worry about. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Patty White.
There are currently three Republicans seeking their party's nomination to challenge incumbent Jared Golden in November's 2nd District Congressional contest. As part of our Your Vote 2020 election coverage, Maine Public is asking each of them about the issues that pollsters have identified as being most important to Republican voters. Senior political correspondent Mal Leary spoke with former State Representative Dale Crafts about health care, the opioid crisis, and, of most concern to Republicans, taxes and spending.
I remember way back when I first got into politics or started thinking about that when I was in high school, when Ronald Reagan came on the scene and did the biggest tax cut that we'd ever seen and stimulated the economy like the world hadn't seen, and caused a worldwide boom. And we see America now as the economy is quite incredible.
But how do you accomplish that goal? I mean, which taxes do you target to lower, and what spending do you target to cut? Because it's got a balance there somewhere.
Well, it is. Well, with spending, we know that in government, I mean, I served up here 8 years, and this is really a tiny budget compared to the federal government. And this, you know, government doesn't run very efficient. I couldn't run my business like we run. We spend money, you know. People are not looking for the pennies to save the dollars. In business, you do that because you're going to make a bottom line or you go out of business. So there's not a revenue problem. There's a spending problem. So I would certainly to try to bring them principles to trying to make government one more efficient. But on the other hand, is certainly if you grow the economy, you grow more revenue. And certainly we want to keep a strong military. I always find that people that you look at the Trump era so far, I mean, the average wage has increased almost $7,000. And so when that happens, people are paying more taxes. When you're paying more taxes, you have more revenue. If you have more revenue, because we certainly got to get this spending under control, because even with Trump and all that he's doing, there's a $1 trillion deficit in the budget, never mind the $23 trillion that we have. So spending's out of control.
Not far behind, though, in terms of the issue of taxes and spending, is affordable health care. Quality affordable health care, I think, is the way most people were phrasing it in the poll response. How do you achieve that goal? Because that is an expensive proposition. No matter which plan that you talk about, there's all kinds of them out there.
Well, I certainly don't want to see some of the proposals with the Democrat candidates where they just want to go to socialized medicine and eliminate the 180 million people in the country that have private health insurance that I'd say they're satisfied with. Certainly, we need this huge deductibles, and there's a lot of, even with that, it's pretty tough to be affordable for anybody. But I'm a free market guy, and I know within business, the more competition you can create, the more prices come down and the quality goes up. If I don't give that service, my competitor will. So in that field, I don't know why that can't take place. Now, we need more doctors, more nurses. You know, there's a shortage of that, which is not causing the competition like it should to bring prices down. You know, the president's got another proposal where to have hospitals be more transparent with the cost of procedures. Now, they say that list is out there. I remember working on that up here, trying to get some of that done. And what's happening is it's kind of like two different prices. You have their posted price, but then you have the price of where they negotiated with the insurance company, which is a different price. So the president is trying to get the truth out there on that so that I know people have told me that they'll go to get an MRI done, and it could be $1,600 at one hospital and $1,100 at another one, but people don't know that. I tell you, I'm a big proponent of preventive care.
Sort of a subset of that issue, but one that's very much on Mainers' minds, is the opioid crisis. I don't think there's one of us anywhere in the state who doesn't know somebody who's been affected by this, a mother, a father, son, daughter, cousin, aunt. What should the role of the federal government be to try to deal with this crisis?
Well, again, we talked a little bit about federal government being part of the regulation of it, and we got the FDA and some of the stuff that gets approved. It amazes me sometimes on these boards that we have, like the FDA, that all the experts that are on the boards are actually people that are part of the problem. They're from pharmaceuticals that sit on these boards because they're the experts. And I think there's a big conflict of interest there. I mean, how did we ever get to this place where something so addictive? I watched a news report last night on TV that 30% of the people that go on taking painkillers for injuries end up addicting. That, how did that ever get approved? So, again, as we grow the economy, create more revenue in more research and development in them areas to come up with a painkiller that is not addictive, that is effective, that is very effective, is really the place that the government needs to focus on. And in my opinion, that drug needs to go away, but we need to find alternatives because there are people in severe pain.
That takes care of kind of the preventative side of it, but how do you deal with all those people who have become addicted? That's one of the big issues that we've seen here in Maine. Is there not enough facilities to treat them?
There's not. And I can tell you that I was up to Machias as a drug rehab place up there. I was up there when Senator Mason was running for governor. And some of these Christian or faith-based ones, their success rates are up like in the 70% areas. And some of the government programs only like 12 or 17% success rate of people getting off the drug. So we need to be open to look at, you know, ways to help these other people, because a lot of it is they're not funded federally at all, and there's people more ministry that are offering these things. And then maybe we can look into that a little further, because we got to get people, you know, to get the help. We can't arrest people that put people away. We need to rehabilitate people and get them back to society where they can be productive in life.
Dale Crafts, thanks for taking the time to talk with us.
Thank you, Mel. Appreciate it.
That's Maine Public senior political correspondent Mal Leary. He spoke with former state representative Dale Crafts. For more on the candidates running in Maine's 2nd Congressional District and in other races this year, you can visit mainepublic.org/yourvote. And that's today's Maine News. For more stories, visit mainepublic.org. And join us tomorrow in Maine Calling at 1 o'clock for a conversation with Senator Angus King about national cybersecurity strategy. I'm Nora Flaherty.